Look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring some films of the film noir genre, specifically directed by females, as recommended by Kristen Sales, and this week's episode, I'll be talking about the Wachowskis' 1996 film, Bound. I'm going to apologize ahead of time if this episode is a little bit more loopy, or if there are some more pauses than normal. I'm recording this episode a little bit later in the night, not in the week, but in the night than I normally do, so a little bit tired, bear with me. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. So, Bound, right? This is a sexy film. We can all agree on that, right? Bound is a sexy film, but it is a smart film, and it's great that those two things are equally balanced, because it seems like it's not common to find a sexy and smart film these days anymore. Am I right? I mean, you can kind of find films that are really smart that sort of have some sexiness seemingly sort of tacked on there, and then you can sort of have some films that are sexy but not really smart and intelligent, at least in regards to its genre and the plotting and how the plot unfolds. Just off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of some films that I can kind of categorize as sexy and smart. You can say Soderbergh's Out of Sight. You can say Alfonso Cuarón's Y Tu Mamá También, although the smarts there I think are more insightful in regards to human nature, not so much from the plot, because it is a character-driven piece, not a genre-driven piece. You can, of course, say Wes Craven's Last House on the Left. I'm kidding, you can't actually say that one. I'm just trying to emphasize the fact that, you know, despite the fact that it's late, that I can't think of many films which really can balance the sexiness and the smartness, you know, the brains and the beauty as efficiently as Bound does. And what's great about Bound, too, is that the sexiness and the sexuality of it, not only does it not distract from the story, but it actually plays into the story. It's not just titillation, because there is certainly part of that. Let's be honest with ourselves here, folks. That certainly does come into play. But it has a purpose behind it. It has a purpose behind it for both the characters and the plot, and I really love that. We'll get into that a little bit later. So I guess, why don't we kind of first start out by, I don't know, it's a film noir. Let's first start out by talking about it as a film noir. Being that film noir is a genre that I need to be more acquainted with, that I'm trying to learn more about, I immediately appreciate it, and I actually kind of immediately appreciate any time a film does this, is when it sort of immediately harkens back to the genre it's trying to pay homage to, or when it immediately sort of, when it wears its influences on its sleeve. And really, from the very beginning of Bound, you feel like this is a film noir. Even if I hadn't talked about this movie with Kristen, even if this wasn't part of the podcast, even if this was just a movie that I had seen on my own volition, I would have been able to tell just immediately from the get-go that this was trying to be a film, not trying to be film noir, that makes it seem as though the implication is that it does not succeed. That is not the case. But even if I had watched this on my own terms or on my own time, I would have immediately seen this as a film that was homaging retro film noir in its own modern way, in wonderful ways. And it really kind of starts immediately when you see Jennifer Tilly's character, Violet, come onto the elevator where Gina Gershon's character, Corky, is already sitting there. And because Violet is wearing these kind of like, I don't know if they're horn-rimmed sunglasses, but they have she's wearing these sunglasses which sort of have these points on the end, which sort of seem like they came out of the 1950s or decades old, really, you know, but kind of in a hip sort of retro look. She immediately kind of has that look to her, and even her hairstyle kind of looks like, a 1950s movie starlet. And then, of course, you know, there's other cues as well. You have the soundtrack, which is sort of jazzy, which has a little bit of horns to it, and a lot of stand-up bass that you can really hear. And you you also, Corky's car, her old beat-down truck, despite the fact that it's, you know, not from a genre or not from an era which, you know, in which film noir was still going strong. It's a 1962 Chevy, but it's still that idea of something old, something past its prime, something broken down and beaten. You have the decor of Corky's apartment, the one that she's working on, where the molding, the paint, the design, not the layout of it, but just everything, like the molding and everything, you get the sense that it's maybe this building was built in or hasn't been renovated since the 1950s. And so it has that look of being past its prime, of something that was once glorious and is no longer. And just this idea of this subtle idea of urban decay, at least how you can see it in the decor and in the home setting, which it's really interesting because right after I watched this movie, I went back and watched The Matrix, the first one, because I was very inspired by it. And it's interesting to see the Wachowskis sort of where they came from and how they take their influences and what they love and how they repurpose them for their own usage. And I'll get to that in a little bit minute or a little bit more in a minute, because the other thing I also wanted to hit on in regards to how this film sort of homages film or sort of harkens back to something in the past or a different time is the overall look of Jennifer Tilly's character Violet, specifically in the scene where she introduces herself to Corky. And if you're a fan of the podcast's Facebook page, and I posted a picture on this and wrote a little blurb about it, you can go there and check it out. But it's this sort of half body shot, you know, from her waist up, and just the way that that Violet's hair is styled, the way that her makeup is done, and the way that, you know, the color of her flesh and sort of the even the color temperature of the shot itself and how the film is shot, she has this look about her where she almost seems like she's either been slightly desaturated or like she was shot in black and white, and, you know, her flesh tones are sort of colored in. Have you ever seen that before? Have you ever seen these old photographs, these old black and white photographs or black and white film strips, in which they've gone back and they've added color to them? And so you see that there's a color to it, but you can also see that there's something not natural about the color exactly. But Jennifer Tilly has this look of a 1950s starlet, like I said, especially with, you know, with her hairstyle, and her makeup is very, very even. You know, there's not a whole lot of blush, there's not a whole lot of, you know, her eyebrows and her eyelashes are kind of very dark, but there's not a whole lot of blending. It just seems like she's not pale, but the makeup and her flesh tone is all very even, and is very light colored. And so it does give off that impression that, like, that she stepped out of a black and white photograph, or she stepped out of a black and white film strip, and her color has been added. And I just love that little touch, and it's not something which you really notice throughout the film as it goes along. I think it's just kind of right there, but it's sort of, to me, is sort of immediately hinted at, like, what kind of character she is going to be, what kind of film this is going to be. It's a really subtle look. It was a really subtle little technique, and I loved it. And it's looking at the IMDb trivia for this. It says that the Wachowskis and their cinematographer Bill Pope, who would of course go on to shoot the three, or the Matrix trilogy for them, said that they were very inspired by comic books, and specifically Frank Miller's Sin City. And I haven't read Sin City, I haven't seen the movie, I've seen parts of the movie, but you can just really tell that era, that style, that look and feel is something that they were not trying to emulate, but something that they were inspired by. I said that I watched The Matrix after this, and I don't want to get into too much detail about that film because I'm doing this episode, obviously, on Bound. But it is interesting to see how, once they have more budget and once they have kind of more control and more scope, how they expand on that. Because I'm thinking specifically of the scene when Neo and Morpheus meet for the first time, and they meet in, you know, once again, it's a rainy night, it's downtown, the city is sparsely populated. In fact, you don't see anyone around, but you kind of get the sense of that this building is old and broken down and there's decay, and just like it was built a long time ago but hasn't been maintained and hasn't been cared about. And I almost kind of get the sense, and perhaps this is because we're living in a day and age now where there's cinematic universes and everything's connected, whether it be explicitly like in regards to the Marvel, the DC cinematic universe, or whether it's implied like Kevin Smith's View Askew, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But I almost kind of got the sense that I wonder if you know, the Wachowskis made Bound, and then decades later, maybe 100 years later, the events of The Matrix happened, or at least what we perceive to be the events of The Matrix happened. And I once again, I won't get into too much detail about that, but I do love that idea of sort of this clash, and especially because, you know, it is a film noir and there's an homage, but this is not a retro film noir. This is not a film noir that is being made in 1996 and is taking place in, you know, 1946. This is a film noir which is made in 1996 and taking place in 1996, so it has to look like it's taking place in 1996. And you see that in Violet and Caesar's apartment, how it's very modern and how it's very slick and how it's marble and geometric shapes and everything like that, and how that sort of, how that acts both physically and metaphorically sort of in contrast with Corky's apartment and Corky's lifestyle and just that sense of something which is past and which is crumbling. And then of course there's the distrust of a higher authority and in The Matrix, once again, I'm not going to hit too much on it, but in that you sort of have the higher authority is everything, because authority and reality in general is a construct of a computer program which is controlling people. But then in Bound, you're what stands in for your higher authority? Because it's not really cops, it's not really government, you know, those presences are minimal. So what is your higher authority? Well, your higher authority is the higher ranking, you know, members of the mafia that Caesar works for. And it's interesting because the higher authority, you know, quote unquote in this sense, is a body that we should be skeptical of anyway, that we should be opposed to anyway. And, you know, the only way that we can make them the bad guys, or the only way that they can see this as a force that has to be rebelled against, is by creating two characters who are criminals themselves. This is not a revolutionary technique. We've been relating with anti-heroes and criminals in movies for literally decades, but I'm always just fascinated by that, by how a filmmaker can make us ready to be on the side of people who we would normally in real life be opposed to, you know, perhaps even vehemently, because of the stakes of a story involved, because of how characters are crafted, because of how the plot is crafted. I'm always fascinated by that, and I'm especially fascinated by it here in Bound because of using these genre conventions to sort of stand on its head a little bit, where the higher authority that we are skeptical of, the higher authority that we want our characters to kind of overcome, is not is something that we are sort of morally opposed to, but is also kind of different than how it would normally be, than how it normally play out in a standard film noir. And then of course there's also this idea of laying the groundwork for what the Wachowskis would explore more in further films. There's this undercurrent of leather and like kind of a slight or you know, vague kind of S&M feel to it. Specifically in this one, it's sort of it's, you know, we see it kind of peppered about. Actually, the context is somewhat similar because where we see it here is it's a gay bar that Corky goes to, or a lesbian bar that Corky goes to, and then in The Matrix. Once again, I'm sorry that I keep going back to this movie. I swear that after this, I'm done with it. But it's that rave, that club, whatever it is, where Neo and Trinity meet for the first time, which I think is also really fascinating, because once again, this is harkening back, or not even harkening back, but this is tying back into this idea of sexuality and how sexuality is being used in the film. Because one thing that I found fascinating was if you remember that club scene when Neo and Trinity meet each other for the first time. Neo is surprised when he meets Trinity because he talks about, you know, she's this character who hacked into some database, and he's shocked because he says, "I always thought you were a guy." And Trinity's response is, "Most guys do." And I find that interesting because in Bound, you sort of have these characters and these main characters in this relationship, which are like, most guys would expect our main character in a film noir to be a male. Most characters, most people would expect it to be and want it to be a straight relationship. But instead, not only is it females, it's lesbian females. And that's interesting because, like I said, this plays into the narrative. And I like that. It's not just like, hey, why don't we have lesbian characters in this film just for the sake of you know, showing lesbians in film, because lesbians are not shown in films very often. But I would like to preface, or I would like to step out and say that, like, that in itself has nobility to it. Just, you know, let's make a story which is like a regular story, but with an underrepresented demographic. I can certainly appreciate this. But Bound kind of takes that and also uses it to further its narrative in this way, in the sense of, in this world, let's say the world of film noir, and also the world in, let's say, organized crime, females obviously have a different role, and there are different implications or different expectations of them by being females. And what I was really intrigued by was the scene when Corky and Violet first get together. They're obviously having an affair in the living room of Violet and Caesar's apartment. And Caesar comes home in the middle of it. And at first, he's fucking pissed. He's screaming, you know, you can see that what he screamed is, "What the fuck is this?" Because he knows in his gut that he just walked in on his girlfriend having an affair, right? But then he's immediately calmed down when he sees that, oh, it's a woman. This was not a guy in here having an affair with my girlfriend. You know, my girlfriend would never cheat on me with a girl. This girl is no threat. And so he is immediately relaxed, not realizing that, yeah, his instincts were right. What he walked in on, he was right the first time. And it's because he doesn't expect that from Violet and Corky. It's because he doesn't expect too much from Corky because she's a woman. It's because in his world, women play a certain role, that they are able to undermine him, that they are able to move forward with this plot to rip him off, because he is always going to be underestimating and overlooking both Violet and Corky because they are women. And that's just one of the things, and I really, really appreciated how that kind of sets it up. I should add, there's also something interesting to me about combining these two worlds of homosexuality and then also leather, S&M, whatever you want to call it. Because it's sort of putting those two things together, especially in a story or a film like this where our main characters are criminals, sort of forces you to ask questions about, you know, not where your priorities lie, but really, you know, what is the difference? Because there are certainly still contingencies of people out there who kind of think that there's something wrong with homosexuality and there is something wrong with people who are into leather or S&M or what they would kind of consider like alternate sexual styles or sexuality. And well, that's wrong, and I don't want to see this. This is kind of gross. This is weird. This isn't what I want to see in my movie. This isn't what I want to see from my main characters. But the thing about that is also like, yeah, but they're criminals too. How are you gonna plant your flag on the moral hill of like opposing homosexuality or a sex life which is somewhat different from yours? But you're gonna say, oh, but you know, but it's okay that they're criminals. That's interesting to me that putting those, you know, those things together kind of make you question that in regards to like, well, I'm going to relate to this, but I'm not going to relate to that. It's like, why? Why are you going to draw the line here or there? Where does this line in the sand come from? I found that to be incredibly fascinating. But there's also a little bit of trivia that said that when the Wachowskis were shopping this film around, they brought the script to a few different studios, and studios kept turning it down, or at least saying that they would make it if they changed the Corky character to a male. So essentially, if the main relationship at the heart of it was a heterosexual relationship between a male and a female, and the Wachowskis kept rejecting that and saying, like, we've seen that story done a thousand times. This is the story we want to tell now. And that's awesome because they stuck to their guns and they made a great film out of it. But it also raises some questions in me, because at first I kind of thought, like, well, what's the difference, you know? I mean, if you think about it, there's not a whole lot that seems to separate Gina Gershon or Corky from our standard male protagonist. You know, she certainly has some of the, what we would kind of consider manly or masculine characteristics. She's good with her hands. She's got a toolbox. She drives a truck. She seems to play the male part of the relationship. So it's kind of, you know, at first I started thinking, you know, like what's the harm in her being a female? You know, is just by, do you see anything different? You know, if she would have been a male, you know, does her make her character any weaker, you know, by being a female? Was there something that a male could have done in this role that would have been better than her? Is there anything that she does that a male wouldn't have been able to do? And I don't say that in the sense of, well, wouldn't this part have been just as good with a male? That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, if you step back and think about it, what's the harm, or not even what's the harm, but what's the big turnoff? Why was it such a big deal for people, for studio executives to kind of be like, well, we'll make it if it's a male instead of a female? And I get that there's this system in place in regards to, like, who is the primary moving going demographic and how's it going to sail and blah, 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 blah. But I'm not, that's fucking stupid that that's the case. I'm more kind of getting to the core of the issue and kind of thinking, like, okay, but where did Gina Gershon drag this down? Or how is Corky the character hindered or made worse by the fact that she was a female versus a male? I think instead, like I said, it actually kind of enhances a character, plays into the plot, because instead what you have is the pickle that these characters get into, or I should say the what happens for this plot to kind of go awry, which is once again a wonderful little characteristic of a film noir plot, is that, you know, we have these the best laid plans of mice and men that often go awry. They plan out what they think is a meticulous heist, and it turns out to not be meticulous. And it's not meticulous because, once again, the male-female dynamic. Because Violet plays her part to a T. You know, she does exactly what she's supposed to do. But part of that involves her accidentally dropping a bottle of scotch so she has an excuse to leave the apartment so that Corky can come in and take the money, so that Violet has... you know, plausible deniability when she says that I have no idea how the money disappeared. I wasn't here. Except things go awry because of Caesar and because of what Caesar thinks and believes about Violet because she's a woman. What do I mean by that? Well, if you've seen the movie, you kind of know already, but let me expound on that a little bit. So the fact that there's, I forget his name. I think it's Michael. You know what? I've got the Internet Movie Database called up here. Why don't I go and look at it? No, it's Johnny. Played by Christopher Maloney, who is, of course, that guy from that cop show, the name that escapes me because I don't care. But he plays kind of a scumbag gangster. You know, he's the son or some relative of the guy that runs this crime family, so he can essentially do whatever he wants. He's kind of a loose cannon. And he's got a clear thing for Violet to the extent of he's hitting on her in front of Caesar. So, when Violet leaves the apartment to get this bottle of scotch that she accidentally broke to give Corky time to come in and take the money so that Violet has plausible deniability, when she comes back, she's playing her part, but where the plot starts to go awry is that Caesar, because he is a man, and because I have to assume is a man who is insecure with himself and insecure in his relationship or trying to compensate for something that's a entirely different conversation, suspects that Violet has something to do... suspects that Violet has something to do with it because Johnny is into her. Now, Violet has no control over this whatsoever. Violet, in the sense of Caesar's suspicions, is a victim, you could say. You know, she is not proactive in this. She has not contributed anything to it. But Caesar is immediately suspicious of her because of what he sees as a dynamic between men and women. At least because he sees that in his own life, that he is attracted to this very attractive female, that he automatically kind of assumes that, well, I'm attracted to her, she's attracted to me, she likes me, so if Johnny is attracted to her as well, then she must be attracted to him, or at least maybe she's doing something to encourage that. Maybe they're in cahoots. There's no basis for that whatsoever, other than in Caesar's mind. But it's because she is a woman that he starts suspecting that. It's because, I was about to say it's because she's a woman that the plot goes awry, which makes it seem like I'm pegging things on her. But what I'm saying is that within this genre that is so dominated by males, the Wachowskis can take a relationship between two females and take two female characters and add something in which the plot bends and the plot twists because of what they bring to the plot, because of what they're, because of what's inherent with them as characters, or what's inherent in expectations from other people about them. And I find that to be fascinating, that the fact that they use the femininity, the fact that they use expectations or I'd say expectations, both real and defied, to make twists and turns in this plot. And I really appreciate that. And once again, this is where the sexuality and the sex comes into play, and the fact that it's not just, hey, let's just have females in here for the sake of being females, which once again I do want to say that there is validity to that, I say this as a white cis male, that it's, there are, not every moviegoer is a white cis male, so it's good for others to kind of see themselves represented on screen. But it's good to also see that it's like, they can take something and say like, hey, these females are going to add something different and something new to this story, that these female characters are not going to be here just because they're females, but because they're going to add something to a genre which has been so standard and so one way for such a long time. Here's how we're going to mix it up. Here's how we're going to twist it. And it's going to be different, and it's going to be better because we're doing that. And I really, really appreciate that, the fact that sexuality plays into it. Because, let's be honest with ourselves. And if you've, written something before, or if you just see a lot of movies, you see that a lot of times it's a character is just a straight white male. And why is that? It's because it's been straight white males for such a long time, and because a lot of straight white males come into it, and because a lot of straight white males know a whole lot about what it is to be a straight white male. And so they're naturally kind of skeptical when they see something which is not a straight white male, or when they see something that's outside of that, or they kind of wonder, why is this way? Why is this different? And the Wachowskis with Bound are answering why it's different, because it adds a different dynamic, because, there is certainly the level of like, hey, Gina Gershon can play this part just as well as a male can. Corky being a female is just as good of a character, is just as good of a protagonist as if it was Corky the guy, the guy plumber down the hall. I was about to say down the road. But because they are female, and because in the world of film noir and in the world of the mafia that Caesar is in, and this world that Wachowski has created, because there are expectations of women, because there are roles that women typically fill, and because they are not fulfilling those roles, that adds something to the story, that adds a twist to the story, that drives the narrative forward, and that puts tweaks on the genre. And I love that, and that's really smart, and it's really intelligent, and of course it is incredibly sexy when they have sex. Let's be honest with ourselves, these are two very attractive women, so it's a sexy and it's a smart film. Bound is a very sexy and a very smart film. And it's also, it's also a film where two lesbians end up happily ever after, I mean, one of the things that was so great about Carol from last year was the fact that it was a lesbian story in which the lesbians weren't miserable, they certainly went through their misery, but in which it didn't end by lesbians being miserable or lesbians having to turn over a new leaf or having to change the way they are. It was lesbians being together, happily ever after. We're going to be together and we're going to be happy. And it's kind of crazy to think about it, but it's so rare that that happens. And yet we have it happening here in 1996, 20 years before Carol comes out. We have a lesbian couple ending up together, riding off in the sunset, happily ever after, with $2.176 million. They're not suffering for who they are. They're rewarded for being who they are. And they're probably going to live happily ever after by and for being who they are. And it's kind of crazy to think, but that was, well, that was and that is still revolutionary. And that's strange to me. The more I think about it, the more the stranger that becomes. But hey, that's I guess that's how it is, and hopefully, hopefully that changes, and hopefully that starts changing really quick. But that's pretty much all that I have for Bound at this point. Like I said, it's kind of a late night here. I feel like this was a little bit rambly, but hopefully I said enough stuff in there which sort of made sense. And if I didn't, it's easy enough to get in touch with me, but I'll get to that in a little bit. It is before I get to that, it is super easy to get a hold of Bound if you really want to see it, and you should really want to see it. If you've seen it before, see it again. Why not? I ended up like a sucker paying for it. You can get a SD or HD rental on Amazon for like $3 or $4. Despite the fact that I recorded this introductory episode with Kristen and went over the ways that it's easy to get your hold of, and I mentioned specifically it is free on YouTube. I forgot that it is free on YouTube. Do not be like me. Do not forget that Bound is free on YouTube. You have to sit through some ads, but there's no payment. It's really good quality, actually, so, you know, it's not like a replication of a replication like it might have been with The Hitchhiker. It is high quality. It's good. Watch it on YouTube for free. If for some reason you have some type of moral quandary with getting media for free and you feel like you have to pay, it's like $3 or $4 to stream it on Amazon Prime. You can rent it or purchase it off of Apple iTunes. You can also rent and or purchase it off of Google Play. Or if you're still hanging on to your Netflix disc subscription, that's all you have. Luckily for you, it's available there as well. So easy enough to get your hands on Bound. And I found this very interesting. If you have the time to do it, I would really also encourage you watch Bound and then watch The Matrix right after it. Maybe take a break, get something to drink, have something to eat, but see how these films complement each other. See how the Wachowskis laid down the foundation for the kind of filmmakers they were going to be, the kind of interest that they have in the genre and in storytelling. And it's really interesting to see how they expand on those things. And it's also, I think, also kind of really a shame that after The Matrix, they then took it in the direction of The Matrix Reloaded and The Matrix Revolutions. They kind of got rid of what made The Matrix really fascinating. And the neo-noir characteristics kind of got thrown by the wayside as we explored more about computers and underground machine wars and blah, blah, blah. I'm boring myself already talking about it. But watch those as a double feature. It's really interesting, and you'll kind of see a lot of cool little similarities, including the horn cue that kind of starts out The Matrix at, I don't know, that it kind of sounded like a bad Inception sound, but you know what I'm talking about. You can kind of see that with the groundwork of where that's laid down and Bound, and even the phones that, you know, the phone ring when everyone's kind of inside The Matrix and they have to pick it up to get out, it's the same phone ringtone as it is in Bound, which I find really, really fascinating as well. But yeah, that about does it for me. I am always very curious to hear what other people think, especially if you are not a white cis male. I want to hear from you and your thoughts on Bound as well. So feel free to drop me a line. It's easy enough. YouDoMoviesBadly@gmail.com. Find I Do Movies Badly on Facebook. You can find me on Nolan Fixes Teeth. If you want to catch up on back episodes, it's easy enough to do that. Just find I Do Movies Badly on iTunes. And go to BattleshipRetention.com. There's a podcast drop-down menu where you can also find all my back episodes as well. So that is it for Bound. Be sure to tune in next week where I'll be wrapping up film noir and with Jane Campion's 2003 In the Cut, and well, hopefully I'll be just a little bit less ignorant and a little more eloquent.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.